Good evening.
Good evening.
Flowing on in the darkness, as we do. We come to the ninth talk. The willow tree cannot be broken by the snow. We don't know snow metaphors so well, at least not anymore, because we just don't do snow. But that's the truth of it at Hokoji. They have great willows. Though actually the large branches are pretty fragile. He's talking about those gorgeous little Japanese ones that he's talking about the difference between being tough and being gentle all the way through here. And saying you have to be both. And that although we admire toughness and think softness and kindness is a weakness, that true toughness and strength comes from entirely this being soft and gentle. And he points out right away that the Japanese people are that way. They're very tough, which is true, but they're extremely kind. I was in Japan with Blanche. It was pouring rain one day. It just started to come down when we were in the little fishing village far from the temple. And I was trying to figure out what to do about all the rain, and a lady came by with an umbrella and just gave it to me. Here. And it's not uncommon. A friend of mine left her traveler's checks and passport and everything in a taxi and was driven far, far away, and the taxi went all the way back to Tokyo, discovered it, and drove all the way back to where she was to deliver it. It's that way. Even though underneath, they're not so kind with each other. There's a lot of backbiting, and it's very, very hierarchical, and if you don't bow exactly the right way, you lose a lot of face. And if you don't give the right kind of presence, and you have to give presents all the time, then you're looked down on if you didn't bring the right kind of tea towels. It's very organized society. But there, it's infused with this feeling of kindness and of connection. Very, very connected. Partly because it's an island, I think. The island people all feel, I think, very together in a way that us in a big continent don't feel in the same way. He said, with the soft mind, you can be really strong. The strong person who is very kind will support people. And that's, of course, the crucial part of it. That if you're able to connect with other people with strength and kindness, then your whole system is operating. Unless you can endure the bitterness of defeat, you cannot really be strong. And that's the other part of it. We try so hard to do it and do it right. But often we learn from our failures. So this is about the front and back feet walking, back foot walking. Darkness and brightness, absolute and relative, pairs of opposites. He says this is a very good way of explaining oneness, or the actual function of a pair of opposites. It expresses how we apply pairs of opposites like delusion and enlightenment, reality and idea, good and bad, in our everyday practice. People who feel they are strong may find it difficult to be weak. People who feel they are weak may never try to be strong. This is quite usual. But sometimes we should be strong, and sometimes we should be weak. If you remain weak always, or if you always want to be strong, then you can't be strong in the true sense. Funny subject, really, how to be strong, how to be, really, how to be in the world. If you think you're always a student, you can't learn anything. The reason you learn something is in order to teach others. So again, you have both sides. And if you focus on one side and ignore the other side, it's not in balance. Jung says, if both sides are conscious, then the mind transcends them both. It's not like it glues them together. It's like there's another truth in there that's invisible as long as we focus on one side or the other. And then he talks about a moral standard, because right and wrong is so crucial, good and evil. And people are always asking about what should we do about the evil in the world. He talks about the precepts. And about being independent. He says when people are competing with each other, they're not so strong. When each becomes completely himself or herself, they have absolute power. Says, although they're opposites, that light and dark are equal. And actually, they define each other. All these opposites define each other. We know what dark is because we have the absence of dark is light, and the absence of light is dark. That's how we define them. So even front foot and back foot. And if you think about the feet, as he says, which one is the front foot? Because in another second or so, that one's the back foot. Nothing holds in that way. Nothing sticks. Then he uses the question of how our food goes through us and how we eat an individual thing like a cabbage or a loaf of bread, but they disappear into us and are transformed into something else. And so if we become attached to the form of the cabbage or the bread, then we can't digest our food. It doesn't work. So this is all about how we use our mind and become attached to things. how quickly an idea or a concept, especially in terms of two sides, becomes so attractive to us, and we want to hold on to them. It's my side. It's just like the Republicans and the Democrats. You know, and we just think we're absolutely right about our side, or we hope to be, or it's very hard to step back and hold it loosely, because we need to make distinctions. We need to think very carefully, and in particular, but to hold whatever we're thinking very loosely. He says, if I say that you should just sit zazen without thinking, you may feel that you shouldn't have any thoughts. You'll be caught by the idea that the right foot is ahead and the left foot is behind, and then you can't walk anymore. When you're actually walking, you have no idea of left foot or right foot. But if you are self-consciously aware of your feet, you cannot walk or run. And it's the same with zazen. As soon as we start thinking, oh, I shouldn't be thinking, you're just ranting and raving in your mind in some kind of way. It doesn't help. So he calls this Sekito's interpretation of reality in the light of independence, which is a made-up word. And he says this is the foot in the front foot and the back foot in the poem is sort of wrapping up this part of the poem. And immediately a student in the discussion asks him about independency. He says, what kind of word is that? And Roshi says, independent is too strong. If you're independent, and he hits the table, bam, with his stick, that's all. You don't care about anything. That's not what we mean. When you are independent, you are in a very vulnerable or dangerous situation. I thought that was very interesting. This is, in America, a very strange thing to hear, because in America we're supposed to be independent. We're supposed to teach our children to be independent. And he's saying that isn't how life works. He goes on to say, when people think I am independent, it's not true. You're dependent on everything. You're completely dependent on everything. So that independent stance means that we are putting ourselves way out there, disconnected. And it means not only disconnected from support and help to us, but our ability to support and help others. So it becomes a very dangerous place. It can often be a place of tremendous boredom or depression. That strange feeling that things aren't right. That feeling that I'm all alone. So one of the students says, I have some trouble with the relevancy of this lecture. to love that. Okay. It's so delicately said. What the heck do you mean? What does this mean to my life? He wants him to say one more thing about it, but he doesn't know what he wants to hear. And Roshi says he's trying to open a different approach to reality, to understanding reality. You're observing things from just one side or the other, and you stick to one-sided understanding. That's why I'm talking this way. Strictly speaking, Buddhists have no teachings. We have no God or deities. We don't have anything. What we have is nothingness. That's all. So how is it possible for Buddhists to be religious? What kind of composure do we have? That will be the question. The answer is not some special idea of God or a deity, but rather the understanding of the reality we are always facing. Where are we? What are we doing? Who is he? Who is she? When we observe things in this way, we don't need a special teaching about God, because everything is God for us. Moment after moment, we are facing God, and each one of us is also God or Buddha. So we don't need any special idea of God. And that may be the point. So then a cheeky student says, that sounds very good to me, but then why do we take vows? You're really pushing him. And that's a very interesting question, because people are always considering vowing precepts as making promises, which is always an impossible position to put oneself in. I promise this will always be so. I promise I will never tell a lie again. I will always be a good girl. It's impossible. We can't live like that. We don't live like that. And although sometimes we try and try too hard, sometimes it's a good idea just to be a little naughty, just to break through that side that we cling to in order to try to be so good. I think Zen students are like that sometimes. We do so well, and we feel so well in our practice. On the other hand, it's very important to take the precepts extremely seriously as a guide. And ultimately, as Roshi says, to learn how to say, I'm sorry. That that's really the basis of practicing the precepts. We mess up, but we can always say, I'm sorry. So that's the other side again of the soft and the hard. Taking the soft side and just being willing to admit messing up and connecting with the one we messed up with, rather than taking a stand and being better than we are. Protecting ourselves in a way that's not useful. It's hard to say I'm sorry sometimes. It's really, really hard. But it's such a mercy. It's lovely to hear, and it's lovely to say. It's a nice practice. there was a little discussion on Facebook about taking care of dying people and what to say to them, especially if they're in pain. And one person who works in that field said, well, what she usually says is, oh, it's going to be all right. Don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. And somebody else wrote and said, yeah, but it's not really. And it's much more helpful to acknowledge that it's not so good. Say, yes, I know. I'm sorry. It acknowledges the situation in a soft way that actually is a relief. It's an admission. So a student says, how to be aware of all these polarities and precepts without being conscious of being aware? How do we do that? Self-consciousness sort of fixes things, and that's not real either. It fixes the chain. And Roshi says, yes, and when the chain is fixed, it cannot move. But still, you should move. Time doesn't wait for you. So you should go on and on following reality. If you think about this point, you will already have started to walk. But if you just remain thinking about it, it doesn't work and you're not walking. You cannot think the same thing always. You cannot always stop and think. You should just go on and on. You have to accept that you're going on in that way. Since you have to accept it, and since you have to live in each moment, then you are actually living in each moment. Then you should do something. Say something, the Rinzai master shouts. Say something now, and strikes the table with his stick, Roshi does. What do you say? That's the point. Speak up. Act up. Do it. So, questions, comments? Jeffrey?
Well, I think this particular chapter for me points to in the time period in which I was raised, the discussion about being strong and independent, raised on American Westerns, mm-hmm. and certainly having those put up to me and saying that those were valuable models of behavior. So I was thinking as a boy, to what degree that informed the way I was wrestling with reality and how it was forming my character. That there was more John Wayne than mm-hmm. there was Mr. Rogers
yes.
in my life.
Yes.
And my whole career in as an educator has been to absolutely come to grips with the Mr. Rogers
mm-hmm.
as my model,
mm-hmm.
and to find strength in that kind of kindness that he embodied. But I see I see these two sides and feel them inside myself, you know, as certainly I would say that my primary role models who are, you know, strong. Mm-hmm. Didn't express a lot of kindness. And I say, so I can understand from that kind of point of view, ordinary mind, or mind that's not had an opportunity to reflect on the issue we're talking about. You see how much, what a lack of kindness there can exist at any given moment, in any given situation. And at the same time, you see in situations where people do extraordinary acts of kindness, is where did that come from? Yeah. I know that the older I get, the more interested I am in hearing those extraordinary acts of kindness and how they might unfold in any situation. It's a good topic tonight. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very meaningful.
Thank you. A friend of mine has just published a book called Boy. She got concerned about how boys were being raised in America and what men's experiences are to be a man in the Western world. And she decided that she would start interviewing people and just asking them what it was like. How do you feel being a man? And the stories came pouring out. She interviewed hundreds of people, little boys, old men, and everybody in between, dock workers, farmers, CEOs, every kind of man of every age, and the stories they tell. A lot of it about abuse, of having been so abused by their fathers, and then having to wrestle with that whole side of themselves that the culture keeps telling you you should be like. It's very touching. A lot of it is very, very moving. Beautiful book. Paul?
Dad, as an Army man for 22 years, served in World War II. Very strong man, very independent man, no feelings, not very kind man.
No.
But I was in the Catholic Church at the time and met some priests who were exactly the opposite. So I had a little balance there. My mother tended to stay away from him because he wasn't very nice. He didn't do anything overtly cruel, but he wasn't a close person you were close to.
Yeah.
So it was kind of difficult. My brother and I grew up playing Army.
Yes.
We had guns.
Yes.
Real guns.
Really?
Well, maybe guns.
Oh, yeah. My brothers did, too.
Sure. So that ideal was always out there.
Yes.
And, of course, when I went into the Army, I got to be John Wayne. Now I had a real gun.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. And being out there and actually seeing it and doing it is very different from watching it on TV.
Yeah.
And I got very tired of it. It really wasn't the right way.
Yeah.
So I've become a lot softer. The hard way just really doesn't cut it, especially when you have kids. I didn't want my daughter to grow up like I did.
I understand.
And I could do something about that.
You could.
So, although it was hard, because at the beginning, I had just gotten out of the Army, so you better tell the line, kid.
Yes. Yes.
But the Zen training that I was doing at the time helped soften me up, too. So, I've had the benefit of really good teachers. And I see my dad in a different light. He was one of eight kids.
Oh.
Grew up in rural New York, upstate. Ran away from home at 16. because his dad tried to shoot him. Well, he turned him in for having a still. This is in 1922.
Oh, Paul.
Dad turned his dad in.
Okay.
And then his dad went after him with a shot.
Right. So he got kicked out.
He left rather than get shot. So he had his troubles too.
He sure did.
So, yeah, that was...
It goes on generation after generation unless somebody can stop it.
That's right. R.D. Lang.
Mm-hmm.
The book he wrote, Knots.
Yes.
Yeah, I broke the chain.
Yes.
He was in practice. I stepped aside. Yeah.
And they say as you step aside and break the chain that it solves seven generations back and seven generations forward. So in terms of the large time that we inhabit, it's a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
To break that chain.
And there's a koan for that, of course.
Yes.
The way is simple. It just avoids choosing. Picking and choosing,
yes.
So you don't hold on to any position.
Exactly.
You pick and choose, but like you said, you hold it lightly.
Yes.
Yeah. Took a while.
Yeah, it does take a while. It's hard. Oh, thank you.
The question I had was simple. And whose saying was that?
The picking and choosing saying?
Oh, no, that, you know. The seven generations.
Yeah. Oh, that's... I've heard that and read that all my Zen life.
Oh, your Zen life.
Yeah.
Okay, so you think it's some sort of Zen Buddhist
experience. It's a Buddhist understanding about time.
Time.
And karma. Coben said it. I know I've heard it from Coben, but I've read it also.
It's very powerful.
Yes. Yeah. That's why what we're doing is so important.
Yeah.
Don't leave on the dog.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's a little after 8. I guess we should stop. You look like you have an announcement.
Yes. So, those who were not here last week, the friends have asked us to fill out a waiver of holding a libel for anything that happens while we're here. Each attendee they want. So some of us have already filled them out, but I don't know if Marie is here, and Carolyn and Paul. Angie probably didn't bring hers.
What makes you think that? Excuse me?
Okay, I'm...
recognize the dangers and hazards inherent in this activity.
Yeah.
It really change your life. I'd be careful.
So we put, for the activity, we just put floating Zendo. So they really didn't give us
that covers the whole thing.
Yeah.
In a vague enough way.
Yeah.
Okay. Do I sit?